Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Traditionally, Americans have shied away from calling even their most despised political enemies fascists. Comparing an American politician to Hitler or Mussolini has always been considered a bridge too far because it was inconceivable that someone would be that bad. It was inconceivable that anyone running for any office, much less that of the President of the United States, could be a fascist. But today, those accusations are flying like travelers at holiday time. Mostly, it is Donald Trump who is being labeled as a fascist, and by people like the Trump-appointed former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, who told journalist Bob Woodward for his latest book that Trump, quote, is the most dangerous person ever. I had suspicions, he says, when I spoke about his mental decline, but now I realize he is a total fascist. And Trump's longest-running White House Chief of Staff, Marine General John Kelly, described Trump this way in a series of interviews with The New York Times.
Authoritarian admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure.
It is rare that presidents speak derogatorily about others who have held the office, but the White House confirms President Biden has called Trump a fascist. And he has said he would be a dictator on day one, Mr. Trump has. And recently, CNN's Jake Tapper asked Vice President Kamala Harris about it.
Do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do.
But Trump has also thrown around the word to describe Vice President Harris on several different occasions.
She's a Marxist, communist, fascist, socialist.
We have a fascist person running who's incompetent.
Somebody's got to explain this woman. This is a radical left Marxist, communist, fascist.
Wait, can she be all three? Aren't those ideologies incompatible with each other? Do these accusations of being a fascist fit either of these candidates or their supporters? We're going to spend this hour exploring that with Anthony Solari, teaching assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State University. Burkhard Henke is chair and professor of German studies at Davidson College, and Will Weissert is a national political reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome to all three of you. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Burkhard, I'm going to begin with you because accusations of fascism are flying backward and forth from both sides. And since most people alive today did not live through World War II, do not have much experience with Nazi Germany or Hitler or Mussolini's fascist regime in Italy, I think we need to begin with a very basic question. What constitutes fascism, and how do you know when someone is a fascist?
Well, that's an excellent question, one that has been vexing historians and political scientists alike. Hitler's most famous biographer, Sir Ian Kershaw, famously called the attempt at defining fascism that it's like nailing jelly to the wall. So it is difficult to distinguish it from authoritarianism and from totalitarianism, but it has a very historical origin. In fact, the term fascism, as Mussolini adopted it, comes from the Latin fasces, which was an instrument of power, really, for Roman magistrates. The lictors were allowed to carry an axe that was stuck in between a bundle of rods, and it was demonstrating a sense of unity, of course, but it was also an instrument of punishment that these lictors could inflict on opponents. So Mussolini chooses this this term in order to highlight him being the heir really of the Roman Empire. But today, and the kind of fascism that he then enacted was really a far right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology that is the direct result, really, of World War I.
So World War I.
Go ahead.
Well, we're going to talk, Tony Solari, about fascism particularly, but since Burkhardt just said that it's difficult to define and totalitarian is part of it, does it matter when you're running for an office, whether it's the president or something else within the United States of America, a democracy, if you are considered to be a fascist, a communist authoritarian, a socialist authoritarian, or just an authoritarian? Does it matter? If you fit the category, should you be running? Should you be elected?
If that's a question to me, to me, doesn't really matter. I'm not a great friend of the fascist label, really, because my understanding of fascism is largely historical. But I think it is helpful in the sense that it draws attention to the grave threat that is posed to our democracy. It runs the risk of exaggeration. And that was perhaps that might not be so useful.
That was actually a question for Tony Solari, because he's the political scientist here. So go ahead, Tony, answer it if you can.
Well, thanks. You know, look, I mean, my take on this is that these words, fascist, socialist, communist, they're being tossed around for political expediency, largely. They're trying to label one another as the bad guy, using words that, the American public, communist, socialist, fascist have come to be associated with, with the worst kinds of political regimes. But I think what would help is to try to get some definition to the words socialist or communist or fascist. And then, compare that to what actually Kamala Harris and Donald Trump say, and leave it to the listeners to see if they, kind of use their judgment on whether those terms really, are appropriate. That's the way I would look at it. And with that said, I think Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, Franco's Spain, I mean, I think Burkhardt's exactly right. They're very different kinds of regimes. They have different political histories, cultures, and so forth. It's hard to give a general definition of fascist, but if you want to distill down some common elements, I think you find that they're a phenomenon of the far right on the political spectrum. They take authoritarian or dictatorial kinds of approaches to governing. They are non-democratic processes, or at the best, if you want to call it that, either they do away with democratic practice entirely, or there's a facade of democracy, right? Where you may have sham elections where people show up, but maybe there's one party or only one kind of vote gets counted. There's a virulent nationalism, right? An ethnic, racial in basis. So forcible suppression of political opposition, an attack on the suppression of the independent media, use of judicial system. To jail opponents. And curiously enough, in many of these regimes, an approach to women that's very traditional in orientation. So I think you can distill down fascist regimes to these common elements. I also think that they have a pretty consistent, coherent ideology to them. A logical worldview. So, look, with all of that said, okay, let's focus, I'll focus on former President Trump for the moment. I don't see him as a fascist, frankly, if you look at that list of kind of generalizations. I think he's certainly authoritarian in character, would like to be an authoritarian ruler. But I don't see him having the, Donald Trump has been all over the place in his statements about, what he's going to do and what he's not going to do. It's hard to see that he has a consistent ideological perspective to some extent, at least as you might define that in a political science sense. But if you listen to him, he clearly says he'll do the following, as Mike, you've said, right? He says he'll use force, military or otherwise, to crack down on those who oppose him. He'll jail his political opponents or those he considers, as he quotes, enemies from within, which is a loaded phrase, frankly, historically. He'll shut down the press or those who aren't supportive of his perspective. He talks about mass deportations of those he considers undesirable. Real Americans is a word that is tossed around a lot. But, if you look at this, his words, this there's a kind of authoritarian bent to what he's saying.
But everything you've just said meets the classic definition of fascism. And Will, because you cover national politics and have for a while, have we ever had this degree of these accusations flying back and forth using the worst possible description of somebody? To be a fascist in the United States or a communist in the United States has always been the worst thing that you can be. Is this unusual? How unusual is this?
Well, you know, like you said in your open, that this is, you know, to get where we are at this point in the campaign is quite unusual. I think what's interesting with the vice president specifically is this is something she's really built towards. She was asked a couple of weeks ago during a radio interview in Detroit. The host said, "This is fascism. Why can't we just say it?" And she said, "It is fascism." But she didn't actually call former President Trump a fascist. She just continued to talk about it sort of around the issue. The interesting thing about the CNN town hall last week was she actually said, "Yes, he is." And then she called him that himself, sort of escalating that step. But I, you know, I agree. I think the way that she's using the term is sort of a catch-all to really, you know, paint Trump as an authoritarian who, you know, is out for mass deportations, who will jail enemies within, which he sees as fellow American citizens. And it's really sort of a political escalation more than an actual sort of historical definition of what these terms mean. As far as, as former President Trump goes, you know, during his rallies, he will often call, a lot of people, including the vice president, names. It gets the crowd going. I don't think he's really interested in, you know, the classic definition of communist, socialist, or fascist. He just says that because it gets the crowd going, and it's a way to sort of turn an attack that might be against him on his opponent. The other interesting thing to think about this is, you know, the vice president today in Washington is going to the Ellipse and giving a speech on, democracy and how important that is. And she will probably not say fascist, but will talk about how important it is to defend the country's values.
We're talking about fascism this morning and whether the labels match the candidates in this election series on WFAE Charlotte Talks. There are these, Will, there are these allegations of fascism being thrown about by both sides. As you just mentioned, the vice president finally said, yes, Donald Trump is a fascist. But as we heard in that clip that I played earlier, Donald Trump has called her a fascist and a Marxist and a socialist. Clearly, those three ideologies don't exist in the same universe. They're diametrically opposed to each other. But nonetheless, he does throw these insults around. Do they neuter each other?
I think that they are sort of getting at a particular political point that each side wants to make. You know, I think that the vice president built to the word fascism very specifically. She was sort of, deliberate in using it. And she's really using it to highlight this idea that the former president has talked about enemies within being American citizens that his second administration could, in theory, target, which she sees as really an escalation to some of his other rhetoric, which was, you know, authoritarian, but maybe not sort of so explicitly.
I have 60 seconds left, Burkhardt, in this segment. And very quickly, it's unusual that we've gotten to this point in the United States, it seems to me, where we have this authoritarian bent. We're not like Nazi Germany was. We're not like Germany was prior to Nazi Germany in terms of our economic situation. But 50% of the population wants to go in this direction here. Why? I have 30 seconds.
Oh, that's an excellent question. I think Trump has been very successful in using fascist politics. I don't like the fascist label for him, but he does help himself to the playbook in very significant ways. And one of those includes scapegoating.
I have to ask, if you walk like a duck and you talk like a duck, are you a duck? I mean, if he uses fascist fascist playbook and the words that Hitler used, is he a fascist? Why isn't he?
Oh, for new, he is too fickle. He is not driven.
Right. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fascism, something I never thought we'd talk about with regard to a presidential election in this country. But nonetheless, we're talking about it because that's the word that's being thrown around by both sides about the other. Will Weissert is with us. He's a national political reporter for the Associated Press. Anthony Solari is a teaching assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State University. And Burkhard Henke is chair of and professor of German studies at Davidson College. The economic and social conditions that led to Nazi Germany and the rise of fascism in Italy are very different from what we're experiencing in this country today. And in fact, yesterday it was announced that the United States economy is the best in the world. It's the best it has ever been in the history of the country. There's still a lot of people suffering because of inflation, particularly on the lower end of the economic spectrum. But nonetheless, the economy, the stock market, by all measures, employment, etc., has never been better. And yet there is this discontent in the country, not unlike what Germans felt, that led people to adopt or say yes to Adolf Hitler. Why are they saying yes, Burkhard, to Donald Trump's espousing of fascist phrases and ideology?
Yeah, look, I think that there's a big, big difference here between the situation which we find ourselves and the situation where Germany found itself. Fascism as an historical phenomenon, as an ideology, as a movement, is really the direct result of the aftermath of World War I. It was a time in which very weak democracies faced enormous pressures, both from outside and from inside. The war brought back millions of young males who had very little education, who had learned how to kill and very little else. They came back to the country facing an economic depression that was unheard of, living in Germany in the face of a global economic collapse, living also in the face of Bolshevism. None of this is the case in the United States right now. And what is also not the case.
So why is it attractive? Why is it attractive then? None of that is the case.
Oh, because the messaging is attractive, of course. I mean, national renewal, lying to your public by saying that our country is failing, lying to the public in saying that people abroad are laughing at us because we are failing. None of this is true, but it will all resonate. And Trump helps himself to this kind of rhetoric all the time.
But Tony, a lot of the word lie and applying the word liar to a candidate for president is foreign in America, but it's become common now because Donald Trump lies all the time. Mm-hmm. And the lies are demonstrable. Why do people believe that the country is going to hell in a handbasket? Why did they believe that we are a garbage can for the world, as he said over the weekend at his Madison Square Garden rally, when they can look out the side the door and that is not the case?
Yeah, look, there are a couple of things I'd like to say. I mean, I'd like to step back and just make clear an earlier point. I mean, even though I don't agree with the term fascist to describe Trump, I think it's very clear based on what he says. And look, and I think you have to take the guy at his word. I mean, some people try to dismiss what he says as bluster, but, you know, I don't. I think you take people at their word. And I think it's very clear that if he were elected again, he would govern in a dictatorial, autocratic fashion. So with that said, look, my take on it as a political scientist is that it's not... the dissatisfaction that's going on in the electorate is real. Let's be honest. If you look at the polling, you look at the studies of the electorate, we find consistently that Americans, I just read some data on this the other day, Americans are dissatisfied with the political economic system in the country. There are different reasons for that. The white working class has been left behind by globalization. They've seen their standard of living decline. There's dissatisfaction with the what seemed to be an increasingly undemocratic nature of the political economic system, that it's dominated by elites, wealthy elites. I mean, this is something that that has been a core of Donald Trump's populism. The liberal side of the equation have made this argument. So I think there's a general dissatisfaction with the way the political economic system is operating. And I think Donald Trump is picking up on that. I mean, I think it's really the source of his populism. So, you know, he kind of exacerbates the situation with some, you know, kind of language, but I think there's a real dissatisfaction in general among the American people with the way things are going. So I think that's part of the answer. You know, there's, if you look historically, and one thing I think it's important to note, right? There are historical precedents in the United States for this kind of behavior in presidents, right? You have the Alien and Sedition Acts that were around the time of the founding. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. Woodrow Wilson suppressed the media, World War I. McCarthyism. Andrew Jackson, the forcible relocation of Native peoples and his ignoring of the Supreme Court. So you look at our history, right? And there are examples, clearly, you know, of this kind of, you know, kind of heavy-handed authoritarian rule. Now, one could say that those were, you know, periods of national emergency, and there are some differences, but there are some precedents for this kind of thing in our political history. One last thing I'll say quickly is, you know, look, I think that we as political scientists have long known, if you go back and look at Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics, we have known that there is a proportion of the electorate, 20%, whatever it is, both right-wing and left-wing, that are not wed to democratic practice. They're just not wed to it. They would be happy to have a dictatorship if it, as long as it fell on their side of it. So you have a portion of the electorate in this country that's not particularly wed to democracy. And you've got a lot of dissatisfaction with the way the political economic system's working on the left and the right. And I think that's part of the politics here.
So, Will, maybe it doesn't matter. I've got two guests here, Burkhardt and Tony, who don't believe that Trump is a fascist, but he does use words and phrases and has a fascist bent or an authoritarian bent to everything. Some have compared his admonition to the Proud Boys prior to January 6th to stand back and stand by. As a dog whistle to them to get ready for the Reichstag event of our lifetime. Some regard his calls for loyalty and his characterizations of his opponents as enemies, as emblematic of fascistic tendencies. How do we know? You're a reporter. How do we know when we're stepping over the line into hyperbole? Because if it walks, I'm going to come back to this. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Well, I think my answer to that would be that's what elections are for, right? Like both sides use hyperbole all the time. I mean, you know, Trump for months has been the opening, you know, statement in a lot of his rallies. And when he starts press conferences, he talks about if he doesn't win, we're going to go into World War III and the economy is going to spiral and all of these things that, you know, that if you're in the crowd and you're cheering him, you know, you don't really believe that that's going to happen. Like, you know, you don't think that when you get back to your house, it's going to catch on fire spontaneously or that the economy is going to collapse, right? But those are things that can absolutely fire up his base, sort of, you know, cast him as the only one that can fix this. And it allows him to basically blame the Biden administration and blame Harris, who was Biden's number two for 4 years, for sort of not keeping their promises and making everything so dire. You know, hyperbole doesn't really hurt Trump on a lot of levels. And frankly, you know, with the vice president, she engages in some hyperbole as well. You know, we talked about how she was sort of more careful to walk up to this line before using, you know, the term fascist to describe her opponent. Because, you know, I think that she doesn't trade in hyperbole quite as much as Trump does. You know, but she does sort of exaggerate sometimes, you know, for effect to get her own crowd going as well. You know, we're right down to the end of the election. Millions of people have already voted early. You know, these candidates, both sides, are doing absolutely everything they can to sort of break through. And sometimes even negative attention is not all negative, because at least it gets you noticed, right? So, I mean, I guess I don't think there's a sort of a political downside to both sides being, you know, to engaging in hyperbole. When the idea is to sort of get a message out that people, that's going to resonate, especially.
Well, these accusations of fascism have been going, and you wrote about this recently in an article that you wrote, Will. These have been going on before this election cycle. The people on the right threw accusations of fascism toward the left during the pandemic because they had these shutdowns around the country, and they call that fascism. It's become this catch-all descriptive word for oppression and totalitarianism, and in some cases even racism. But to use the word and to call a presidential candidate a fascist, I don't think has ever happened in recent memory. It seems like, as I said in the beginning, a bridge too far. But are we here now because we have no place else to go? The temperature is up that high that it's going to burst through the top of the thermometer.
Well, I can't predict, you know, how much higher the temperature is going to sort of get. We have another week to go, right? I mean, I agree with you. I think that we're pretty right now. Emotions are running especially high. But I will sort of continue to make the distinction that, even though, you know, I think there is a lot of, as we've heard today, a lot of sort of discussion about whether or not historically, these accusations should be traded, they do have political, you know, cachet and political value, and that's why we're hearing them. And, you know, I can see a situation where we're going to continue to hear them for the next couple of days at least. Will this shape the way that future elections look like? You know, obviously we're a very, very evenly divided country. No matter who wins next Tuesday, the other side is going to become very, very close. So it's hard to believe that, you know, the genie will go back into the bottle. By the same token, things shift, right? So it's hard to exactly know, you know, where we'll be.
Burkhardt, your area of expertise is German studies and fascism. In Germany they're the template for it, I suppose, because of Adolf Hitler. I spoke with a Holocaust survivor many times on this program prior to the 2016 election cycle. And when that election was just beginning to heat up, when the primaries hadn't even started, she said that the dialogue, the rhetoric that she was hearing was very reminiscent of what people heard in Germany in the run-up to Hitler taking power. It was the same. And she said, mark my words, we're heading toward fascism. Do you see that? Given all the things we've talked about, do you see that in this country now?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it fascism. I think it'll come in a different dress.
But why not? Why not call it fascism?
Because fascism was an historical phenomenon deeply, deeply rooted in this extraordinary situation that cannot and will not be duplicated.
But if some of the principles of that era survive today in the rhetoric being thrown about by both sides, right, whether we call it fascism or not, isn't it the same thing?
No, not to me. I think there's a difference between using political strategies that fascists use, and Trump does that very well, and it really resonates with people. But there is a big difference between the fascist that Adolf Hitler was, the fascist that Mussolini was, and the quote-unquote fascist that Trump is supposed to be. Using the rhetoric, though, is some, and I can fully empathize with the person who said this. Trump's rhetoric is straight from Nazi discourse. I mean, to be speaking of poisoning the blood of the country is of course an echo from Nazis who felt that they were thinking with their blood, right? I mean, the entire doctrine of fascism is that it is a cult of will over thought and over reason. And to speak of vermin, if I may just add that, is particularly heinous. The most anti-Semitic film ever released by Joseph Goebbels, who wasn't just a propaganda minister, but also in charge of culture and cultural distribution in Germany, three anti-Semitic films in 1940, the most egregious one was The Eternal Jew. It includes a segment that traces Jewish migration from Israel through North Africa to Europe, and then strikes a parallel to migration patterns of the rat.
Here's Donald Trump saying precisely what you just indicated.
They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done.
He's talking about immigrants there. One in three Americans agree with him. Hitler used that term in Mein Kampf, his diatribe that led up to his power. Is this opinion? Is it prejudice? Is it ignorance? Why isn't it fascism?
It is calculated. It is the politics of us versus them, as Jason Stanley, political philosophy professor at Yale, called it. He wrote an entire book about it. He, in part, is he's probably the main reason why we now hear the term fascist bandied about more often than we have before, because he sort of popularized this notion that people can be fascist if they help themselves to these kinds of strategies. And invoking a mythic past is a very effective one. That is, Mussolini said, yeah, okay, we are like the Romans, right? We look back to the Roman Empire. This is where we want to return to. It was immigrants. It was other marginal groups, minorities that ruined this for us. Hitler says medieval Germany is where it was at. We need to return to that. Making America great is a return to the 1950s.
Hey, we're talking about fascism on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. So among the things that have been floated about in this election cycle and some of the things that the Trump campaign and others, Republicans, have talked about is scapegoats, identifying scapegoats for our problems, nostalgic longing for an idealized past, make America great again, disdain for intellectuals, not trusting science, not trusting university professors and people like you, suppression of the free press, which is something Donald Trump has advocated for. He wants to suspend or take away the licenses of the three major networks because he doesn't like what they've done. He wants to go after the New York Times. We've seen the LA Times and the Washington Post back away from endorsing anybody in this election cycle. And although Jeff Bezos at the Post says it has nothing to do with Trump, does it? You'll never know. Obsession with crime. Crime is down in the country, but Donald Trump paints a picture of a country running rampant with crime. The list goes on. And another of these characteristics, Tony, is the co-opting of the nation's dominant religion by a regime or an attempted regime. That these are all things that fascists do. Is Trump's cozying up to the Christian nationalists or his promises that this will be the last time Christians will have to vote because he will end their oppression an indication that he's on that path?
Yeah, it's there's an old saying, and I can't remember who said it, but if dictatorship comes to America, it'll be waving the flag and carrying the cross. Was the
Sinclair Lewis?
Yeah, and so look, I mean, Trump's use of these phrases, of poisoning the blood, and all the rest of it's just unconscionable, right? And it's despicable, frankly, and insensitive to the, you know, lots of folks who have lived through these kinds of regimes. Okay.
You're hearing the music. We have to take a break. We'll do that. We'll give you a chance to recap or regroup and come back with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fascism and the allegations of fascism being tossed around by candidates of both parties about the other. Anthony Solari is a teaching assistant professor of political science at North Carolina State University. Burkhard Henke is the chair of the German Studies Department at Davidson College. And Will Weissert is a national political reporter for the Associated Press. People have said that he's not a fascist. Will because fascism exists in a particular place and time, and that time and place have passed, and the world is different. But he is Donald Trump, using words out of the fascist playbook, and words that have been used in the past that indicate you are a fascist. It would be one thing if President Biden or Kamala Harris, or other Democrats were the only people throwing this accusation around. They are not. General Milley, General Kelly, who was the White House Chief of Staff, the longest serving one under President Trump, others in the former Trump administration have come forward and used that to characterize the former president as a fascist. Should we be listening, given who they are? This is not the other side. These are Republicans.
You know, I think that's really up to the voters, right? I mean, they came out and they made these statements trying to sort of sway the election and to warn the electorate of what, you know, could be in store.
But these are people who don't normally comment on politics. So when they come out to try to, quote, sway the election, as you just said, they're doing that. So they're breaking the mold. They're going against everything, every grain in their body to do that. Should we be listening?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, we'll know the answer, you know, a week from today or in the days after the election. You know, but the timing of this is not a mistake. I mean, they were sending a clear warning to try and get voters to react to, you know, what Trump is saying and what Trump is promising as something that could really be authoritarian. And, you know, I don't think that they're necessarily interested in whether it meets the historical letter of, you know, a definition of fascism. They're looking for more of the political effect of it. And the other thing I want to say is that, you know, the Trump campaign really hasn't engaged on this. You know, when Harris came out and called him a fascist, they just said, well, she'll talk about anything to not talk about the border and the economy. Like they don't really, you know, see it as an insult because it sort of plays into their, you know, into their candidate's, you know, case for why he should be president. So again, I think it really does, you know, sort of boil down to the politics versus sort of the academic and historical definition of things. And I think both sides, frankly, are getting, you know, a little bit of a political ride out of this for different reasons.
Well, so know, I'd like to play off of that if I could for a second. Sure, you know, sure. Will, I think you said something that, you know, really important and interesting. Look, I mean, we can go around and around about whether, you know, Trump is, you know, meets the definition, the classic definition of fascism or not, right? And when I spoke earlier about the idea that each of these fascist regimes historically have had unique characteristics. So, you know, maybe what we say here is that, you know, whether or not he's meets the classic definition, Trump is clearly playing off the fascist playbook and what he says, his statements, you know, his references and so forth. And you know, going back to the argument about the flag and the cross. So maybe what you're seeing here, I wouldn't put too much, you know, I don't know, weight on it, but perhaps what we're seeing here is that in a particular, you know, what's evolving is a particularly American brand of fascism, right? That hasn't fully evolved yet. That's kind of in the formative stages. Not fully fascist, perhaps in the classical sense of the term, as we might define it, but, you know, kind of on the way there. So there's that element of it. One other thing I think is interesting, and this ties into something that Mike was talking about earlier, and we've kind of hit around on, you know, the scapegoating of people, the poisoning of the blood and all of that stuff. You know, the debate over that we've seen really brought up in this election on LGBTQ issues, right? I think there's an argument that totalitarian regimes like Hitler's Germany or fascist regimes, that they're fundamentally anti-modern in character. They've been termed a revolt against modernity. And so you see a rejection of a pushback against the cosmopolitanism of, you know, especially urban elites, against the kind of political liberalism. We see this in Putin's Russia today, against the secularism, which, you know, which really kind of motivates the religious right, against the kind of multiculturalism, the kind of gender fluidity. I think that Trumpist populism partakes of this kind of anti-modern take, right? And the pushback against all these elements which kind of characterize the modern world and American society. And I think, so I think there's elements of that in Trumpist populism as well, and it's become an issue in the campaign.
Let me flip the coin for a second, because Trump has called Harris a socialist, a Marxist, a fascist as well. And those three ideologies don't coexist peacefully at all. They're very, very different. She says that she is a capitalist, but she does advocate tax dollars being used to help first-time home buyers. She does want to make daycare for working families affordable. The only way to do that, really, is through the use of tax dollars. She has advocated for the expansion of Medicaid and for the protection of Social Security, which, by definition, is a social program. She is completely on board, obviously, with the Affordable Care Act, which has given 46 million people access to health care. And she calls health care a right, not a privilege. And prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we did many shows with people on both sides of the aisle, ordinary people, not experts, some of whom said healthcare was a right, some of whom said healthcare was a privilege. And you can figure out for yourself which side of the aisle those people identified with. So, is she a socialist, Tony?
Great question, and I think an important one. Look, I think Vice President Harris is a pretty conventional liberal Democrat. I don't think she's a socialist. Again, I think that's political hyperbole. Look, if you talk about if she were a socialist, what she'd be advocating for would be not just nationalized healthcare, the nationalization of the transportation system, the nationalization of the banking system, the nationalization of energy, right? A highly, highly regulated capitalist economy. You don't hear her saying any of those things. I think she's a fairly conventional liberal Democrat, fairly centrist. The things that you talked about, Social Security, aid to families, that's not socialism per se. I mean, people might say they're socialistic in character, but what they are is they're programs that we have had in the United States for a long time to mitigate the downside of some of the things that capitalism produces, namely an inequality of wealth. I don't hear her advocating things that, real socialists would advocate, frankly.
She will tell you that 46 million Americans have health care because of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and they want to keep it. And that Trump wants to take it away from them. And that will throw these people who have pre-existing conditions out into the cold. And it is true, it seems to me, that the expansion of Medicaid, expansion of the Affordable Care Act are popular programs among people. Don't touch my Social Security. It's the third rail of American politics. If Americans like all of these things, why are they attracted to somebody who would take them away if he could?
Well, the way that Harris frames all of these things generally is she says she wants to use government to make people's lives better, right? She wants to basically take federal spending and improve the lives and the healthcare and the housing and the ability to open a small business and all sorts of other things for the electorate. And one of the reasons she says that is because people are, continue to be upset with inflation, even though it's gone down a lot since the pandemic. There are some economic questions that issue could be potentially a weakness for her. And she's basically saying, here are plans to make your life better if you vote for me. By the same token, what Trump will say is that socialism, he probably doesn't even think in his mind that it is actual like communist, Cuba style controlled planned government socialism. But that's his counter to her sort of saying, I'm going to make the government larger and I'm going to give, social benefits to people using government funding. So again, I think this is really a sort of a political argument in its face, sort of, dressed up in a different sort of policy fight. And it's sort of hyperbole on the other side as an attack to it, right? But again, these are not sort of academic discussions. These are basically one side, doing what it thinks it can do to advance its political agenda, and the other side reacting to it.
Burkhardt, I'm still struggling with. I'm still struggling here, Burkhardt, with the idea that this is not fascism. And so I'm going to come back to you again because you're the expert in this area. Fascism is distinguished by its willingness to defy public civility and openly violate the law. Donald Trump is a convicted felon and an adjudicated sex offender facing other charges in the coming months if he loses this election. He has bragged about avoiding taxes. He had fought to block the Justice Department from retrieving illegally retained top secret documents that he stored at Mar-a-Lago. He blames the deep state and the Biden Justice Department for coming after him for crimes that he allegedly has committed. He talks about the election system being rigged against him. Mussolini and Hitler both repudiated the institutions of their respective countries, as Donald Trump repudiates those in this country. Both agitated against the system that had traditionally governed their countries. If this isn't fascism, are we in for something worse or equally bad? Should the election go a certain way?
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. I am very much concerned. I am concerned, of course, about his authoritarian tendencies, his willingness to defy democratic norms, his willingness to violate the Constitution, frankly.
He wants to
His
suspend the Constitution. He said
I know.
so.
Yeah, and he wants to take control of traditionally independent institutions, right? But look, since we were talking about economic policy, look at his economic policy. That's vastly different from anything that Mussolini or Hitler wanted to do, right? I mean, Trump emphasizes deregulation, free market principles. That's not the kind of state control of industry that fascists promoted, right? Donald Trump may have his Oath Keepers and his Proud Boys, and they're violent and they're splinter groups, but they are small potatoes compared to the kind of paramilitary forces at Mussolini's and especially at Hitler's disposal. The black shirts in Italy numbered in the hundreds of thousands. The SA, the Sturmabteilung, the stormtroopers, the brown shirts, Hitler's brown shirts, at their peak, were had over 4 million members. It is inconceivable for us still, and I return to World War I because it is so important. The brutalization of politics, the cheapening of human life is something that we have a hard time understanding. Open assassinations in broad daylight, the kinds of street fighting that occurred on a daily basis, Hitler unleashing immense violence on people. I don't see that with Trump at all. Trump does not have that kind of resource. He doesn't even have his own party in the way that Hitler and Mussolini had their own party,
He
right? We can
doesn't.
say,
He
you
completely
know,
controls the Republican Party.
he does not. He is still subject to the party. If Kevin McCarthy hadn't gone to Mar-a-Lago and bailed him out after January 6th, who knows what would have happened to Trump's political career, right? It is not the, you may argue that the Republican Party has gone MAGA and that they are servile in a way, but they are not his party the way the NSDAP was Hitler's party.
We're exploring fascism this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Many people pointed, on the left at least, pointed to Trump's weekend rally at Madison Square Garden as evidence of fascism because an American Nazi rally had been held there before our involvement in World War II back in 1939. Was this just symbolism? Did he do it deliberately? Does he even know that? Or was it simply the King of New York coming back to take back his throne?
Yeah, I think it was much more the latter. Trump is a guy of New York. He grew up in Queens, but he loves the city, even though the politics there, no longer coincide with his politics, and he lives mostly in Florida. This is really sort of about him going back, and they talked about how he could help some of the congressional races there, where the House has some very, very close congressional races in sort of upstate New York that he might have had some assistance with. But obviously with some of the racist stuff that came out, he probably didn't actually help a lot down ballot, at least in the short term. I do think that they probably knew that there was the sort of this recalled some of the stuff from the 1930s, but they didn't care because sort of Trump wanted the sort of personal homecoming piece of this. And I just wanted to go back real quick to the idea of the Republican Party being completely controlled by Trump. Obviously, his influence is outsized, but in the primary, you had about 20% of Republicans voting for Nikki Haley and other candidates. So it's not a single party control, and nor are they looking to shut down the Democratic Party in a way that we saw the fascists do on the 1930s.
But he
So
wants
we're
to
not
put
quite there
Nancy
yet.
Pelosi and Adam Schiff in jail, and she came back. Nikki Haley came back to the fold very quickly. Tony, I only have about a minute left. Trump's campaign phrase since the very beginning has been "Make America Great Again." At first, people puzzled about exactly what that meant. Kamala Harris has apparently decided that it calls for a reversion to the past in a time in which the United States was homogenous, so she has adopted the phrase, "We're not going back." But some fear that as Donald Trump and his followers have revealed militaristic tendencies and, in fact, employed them on January 6th, the phrase, "Make America Great Again," plays into another definition of fascism, the use of imperialism and political violence and war as a means to national rejuvenation. Could that be successfully argued today in this country? And I have 30 seconds.
Look, I mean, if we take Trump at his word, and let's say he's elected and he surrounds himself with folks who will do his bidding, then I think, you know, if he's successful in undermining the kind of democratic norms, if he's successful in weaponizing the judicial system, if he puts folks in control of the military, I've heard rumors that some of these Proud Boy types would be put in control of the military, then, yeah, I mean, we're looking at some potentially really dark, you know, and dangerous ground.
And is there any reason to think that he wouldn't? Anthony Solari, teaching assistant professor in political science at NC State University, Burkhard Henke with Davidson College, and Will Weissert with the Associated Press. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.